This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly look at the best in architecture, product design and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today, we speak to Foster & Partners art director Narinder Sagu about putting pencil to paper and the art of architectural sketches.
We have a sketch model shop, and it's really interesting because we actually sketch using cardboard and bits of plastic. We think with our hands.
Plus, how sustainable can a summer house be? Rather, according to one Danish studio.
I think actually the sun is its way up with it not flying to the other end of the world and actually looking at the local spots we have.
And we'll be tucking in at a Brooklyn restaurant that was dreamed up and designed with a few nostalgic nods to its owner's childhoods.
In the summers, we would drive up to Tyler's Cabin, and almost religiously, we would stop at the Turks Inn. And we were always attracted to eccentricity, and the Turks Inn was certainly a part of that fascination for us.
That's all coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. And a very warm welcome to the show. First up, we're speaking to Narinder Sagu, a senior partner and art director at Foster & Partners. As an architectural illustrator, it's his imagination that defines how a soon-to-be-built structure is presented and the tricky negotiation which sees lines on a piece of paper become actual skylines. Buildings Narinder has helped bring from page to place include the swirling Gherkin skyscraper in the City of London to the much-trumpeted glass-domed delight of an elephant house at Copenhagen Zoo, which cost more than peanuts, I can tell you. Monocle's Tom Hall recently met Narinder Sagu at the World Architecture Festival in Amsterdam to learn a little more.
I think I dreamt more about being an artist than an architect. At the time, you know, perhaps being in an Indian traditional family, architecture gave it the body of a profession, something that I could go to university for and prove my worth. Although I was nurtured and, you know, drawing and craft was really celebrated in my household, I just didn't realise how much. Looking back, I was in a very, very fortunate group of family members who were makers and artists in different ways. You know, my grandmother was a seamstress in her part-time, and she would use chalk to draw on fabric and then sew the fabric into outfits. And my father was a metal worker, used the same piece of chalk to draw on metal, cut the metal and fabricate it. And my grandfather was a carpenter, and he drew with pencil on timber. And so the two things were absolutely the same. I guess when I joined the practice, I mean, at architecture school, we didn't really have computers. Everything was hand-drawn. So it was it's a magical time where thinking and communicating happened simultaneously on paper, which I think at the time was being questioned with the entry of the grand computer and CAD systems, that would that craft disappear and be taken over by computers? I remember someone saying to me, what will you do in 10 years' time when a computer takes over what you do? So in some respects, there's the challenges of technology. And that problem never really occurred. It never really faced me. In many respects, technology's come full circle and supports that handcraft that I've always loved. But then there's always been the challenge of studying architecture for 5, 6 years, 7 years, and I did 6, where you're expected to design buildings and build buildings. Then there's been this wonderful revolution in education where students are taking longer time out from education, exploring their maker side, becoming photographers, becoming sculptors, working as art critics and so on, and diversifying within the profession. And therefore, I've been able to, within those challenges as well, being able to kind of carve a role where I'm both artist and designer and architect at the same time.
And you kind of alluded to it there. Well, certainly when you were coming up, people were saying, oh, you're not going to be needing a pen and paper in 10 years, or a pencil, or a piece of chalk even. That has not materialized, but we are seeing technology naturally creep into every element of business, industry, creativity, more and more and more. Would it be a jump of logic to ask whether an architect even really needs to be able to hold a pen and draw and have that level of craftsmanship? I'm not saying an excellent architect, I'm just saying being in the door as an architect. Are we now at a stage where technology is sort of allowing people to articulate their thoughts without that level of skill learned over years?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly not in our practice. The kind of craft of mark making is perhaps stronger now proportionally. When I started, we probably had about 150 people in the practice. We now have around 1,400. Proportionally, there are more people active in drawing and communicating through various forms of drawing. And when I say drawing, I do mean drawing on paper, drawing on canvases, painting, both analog and digital, using iPads, using digital tablets, using a combination of software, working with very precise computer packages and software, with very, you know, loose painting and drawing software applications. And then of course we make models. We have a sketch model shop, and it's really interesting because we actually sketch using cardboard and bits of plastic. We think with our hands. And so that mind-to-hand contact and communication between the mind and hand, which by far is the fastest when you compare it to any piece of technology, for sure, is stronger than ever before, really.
I wanted to sort of come back to something a bit more loosely conceptual. Maybe it's a question about you as opposed to a question about architecture or drawing in general. Do you sometimes take more pleasure in the drawing than when the actual thing gets made?
I think most of the time I take more pleasure in what I'm doing than... I think the skill is to find a balance to, in every mark you make, you know, we're telling very complex, serious stories. Every one of those lines costs money. You know, a single line can improve a person's life, change a whole city, change the planet. So, of course, it's serious. But I'd be lying if I said that I didn't enjoy every mark I make and every drawing I produce. In fact, other than the learning of the skill itself in terms of how to draw, the balance between fun and calculated drawing is the singular skill that I think I've been developing the most over the last 2 decades that I've been in practice, and being able to switch between the two. But most of the time I really enjoy what I do. There's no real differentiation for me in terms of work drawing and drawing at home or drawing on my commute or recording thoughts or drawing with my children. It's absolutely the same thing for me, and I'm very fortunate for that.
Obviously, I think I'm probably going to know the answer to this, because you're going to have to say, it's the building, they're all brilliant. But let's say hypothetically, subjectively, theoretically, I mean, do you ever see a building and think that the physical manifestation of it maybe, let's say, has captured something different to what that very creative first drawing, maybe the energy of it was sort of manifesting itself as?
I think so. This really positively, I'd like to think most of the time I would feel that, and we feel that as a team. Because through the process of design, we're not just trying to predict what that ultimate building will be like. Often we're way ahead of that. We're trying to think about what the future of that building might be like, how it might be repurposed 20 years into its life, 30 years into its life, how it might fit into a place, a city, into a world that has greater risks in 100 years' time. And often we're dreaming of lives that don't exist, but they exist in our minds. So the users of the building, the person who would live in a residential building or a mixed-use building, how they interact with someone who's working there or enjoying the space with family, or how landscape comes in. And then some of those ideas we don't exaggerate, but we push them to a limit where, for example, green buildings become as green as they can possibly get. And then, of course, in the real world, we're challenged by time, we're challenged by cost, we're challenged by technology that doesn't exist. But it's that vision making that has to be way beyond the final product. Otherwise, we've kind of failed ourselves. We haven't really thought big enough if we've only achieved for the next 5 years.
Finally, a colleague of mine at Monocle, Rob Bound, he recently wrote what was an amusing thing. It definitely, I was like, I agree with that. That's something I've seen, where he was talking about architectural renderings, which maybe isn't strictly the same as pure sketch drawing or anything, but it is a part of the visual process.
Right.
These sort of CGI versions of what the building will look like in your community. And he was talking about the individuals that you see in these, the people walking about, like the guy pushing his bike or the woman buying bread or something. And he was just saying, like, how weird they always are. They always look so weird. They have this, it could be, I don't know whether it's about it being on a screen and then being blown up big for the facade of a building. They're a really strange bunch, those people in those renderings. What's going on with them? What's wrong with them all?
It's because they don't belong. Those people, you know, when you cut and paste a photograph of someone and put them into another context, another geography, another society, of course they're going to look strange. We produce renderings in my team. We've gone from a team of just hand-drawn artists to concept artists. We have people from the games industry who are creating matte paintings. They've come from film, where they're creating... Architecture is really about creating a film set, really, for people's lives. And so we use the same tools. And then we don't really refer to them as renderings or visualizations. We call them all pieces of artwork. And there's a significant difference because, like I said earlier, we're not showing people what a building might be like. We're telling stories. So our photorealistic artwork tells the same story that a hand sketch will, but it's more realistic. We can talk about materiality. We can talk about joints and textures within the building itself. But with the life within it, we tell very powerful stories. So, for example, when I draw... And if you watched one of my drawings that's recorded, I find myself always drawing people first, and then the building comes at the very end. More often than not, it just happens that way. And we produce our photorealistic artwork in exactly the same way. We sketch out the story, we sketch a storyboard out like it was a film, we take an instance within that film, a scene, we find out who the protagonist is within the film. So the cyclist has to be there for a reason. And then we tell those stories, and then the building comes in afterwards, and we create a reality where the building is not the protagonist, it's the people. And then we start to get it right. We go around the world photographing the place. We photograph people who actually live there right now and will live there in the future, so they really, really belong in that place. You know, they've got the right colour of sunlight on their shoulders. They've lived there and they belong there, so therefore they should belong there within the future we're trying to create. If we can't get the people right, we have actors, we photograph ourselves, we play out what those sketches might be. We like to think of the photorealism as kind of a form of time travel. We only produce it. And it's rarely going to be exactly what the building's going to look like. But it allows us to travel forward in time with our clients to a point of reality where we can together think about a future far beyond it. So it becomes super powerful in that sense. Your friend is absolutely right. There's a huge amount of mistakes to be made. We're constantly learning and picking out what makes a good rendering, if you like, and what makes a bad one. The common mistakes we find is that people in those renderings are absolutely static. Often, you know, they're on their own. They don't belong to the place. They look bored, they look isolated. So you can fill a rendering with 1,000 people, but when the human brain and the human heart engages with that two-dimensional image of something that doesn't exist, you feel super lonely because all the people are on their own. There's 1,000 people not talking to one another. So that's where the element of storytelling comes in. We make sure that people are never alone. And if they are, they're alone for a reason. We make sure there's movement in the space and people are not just static, because it tells your brain there's something seriously wrong. If cars and people are not moving, people are frightened or people have deserted the cars on the road. So even the idea of movement within the image itself tells a story. It tells you which direction people are moving in. It tells you a story about the architecture itself and, you know, circulation and movement through the space. We're obsessed with that level of detail. We're obsessed with the psychology of the artwork we create. Because in effect, we're looking at things that you know, you and I may not really spot, but our brain knows it's there. And so when our client sees something for 3 seconds, they're either going to love it or hate it. Not just aesthetically, not just because of the architecture that we're proposing, but because something in life doesn't feel right, or it feels absolutely right and makes them feel warm, it makes them feel loved inside. You know, we produce interiors. We never put any people in interiors, because who wants to walk into an apartment and see a stranger standing at the end of your living room or in a bathroom? You just want to step away and walk away from it. But in fact, we want you to kind of go in mentally and kind of fall in love with the place and live in it. We're quite lucky, actually. There's an element of real strong thoughtfulness and research that goes into what we do.
You might even call it an art, mightn't you?
I think it is. Everyone in my team, there's almost 20 of us. Some are architects, some, like I said, concept artists and gamers and interior designers, landscape architects, industrial designers. But we're all artists. And it's really important that we don't call each other visualizers, which is often a process that comes at the end of the design, where the architects feel like they're ready to just create a visualization. We don't really do that. You know, our team has a quite unglamorous name, Design Communications, because we communicate design throughout the whole life of the project. And then we design the communication itself in all the ways that I've just described. And that's super valuable to a client, because we can say, I'm going to be your artist. I'm going to show you what the building's going to be like. And I'm going to describe the complexities through sketches and diagrams. I'm going to tell stories throughout the whole life of your project, not just at the end when it comes to marketing and it's all a big surprise.
Narinder Sagu speaking there to the show's very producer, Tom Hall. You're listening to Monocle on Design, and we'll be talking Danish design just after this.
Swarovski is proud to partner Monocle on Design. The Swarovski journey is a glittering tale of a crystal manufacturer cut from humble beginnings that's grown into a global brand. Over five generations, the company has continued to innovate and to grow. It's a true success story, and one that's far from told. The current custodians of Swarovski are determined that the company will continue to be a glittering model for business, for sustainability, and for community, for generations to come. Swarovski, endlessly illuminating creativity and sparking delight since 1895.
You're back with Monocle on Design, and I remain Josh Fennett. The Danish Architecture Centre in Copenhagen is showcasing three up-and-coming studios that are imagining the future of Danish design. One studio, Mette Lang Architects, is pitching the sustainable credentials of the classic summer house. In Denmark, as elsewhere in Scandinavia, the culture of decamping to a holiday home in the midst of nature remains a popular pastime, more so recently thanks to concerns over the environmental impact of flying further afield. Michael Booth, our Copenhagen correspondent, headed to the exhibition to find out more.
My name is Jasmine Coxaby, and I'm assisting architect at Mette Lange Studio. So what we have here is a wooden pavilion where you have a lot of curtains that you can draw around, and it's supposed to be a way for us to communicate how we work as an architecture studio.
It's a wooden frame about 3 meters high with a sloping roof, but there is no roof. It's just the frame of a kind of G-shaped building. What is the building?
The building is actually taken from one of our projects that are being built right now. We're doing a lot of vacation houses and mainly like wooden constructions. So that's why we chose to have this, this layout. And what we have created with this structure is that we are having a sort of yard space in the middle, and that's a thing that we use in quite a lot of our buildings to create shade and from the wind. And during this tour around the house, you will encounter five different elements that we work with as architects, and it's something just like poetry, materiality, light. What are the things that we can actually hold on to when we are creating architecture? And I think poetry is one of, or at least we called it that, it's one of the most important things we work with. It can be explained as atmosphere, like just when you, just as when you enter a church and you get this feeling that this is a sacred space, like the light comes in from above and you get this this special sense. And we try to create places with some sort of special sense as well.
Can you explain to people who are not familiar with Scandinavian summer house culture?
Yeah.
It's very special, and it's very widespread, and it's very ingrained in the culture here.
It's a place where you can go and relax both in the summer and during the winter, because we have such a lot of cold winter that we also need to be able to use it there. But it's it's a place where you go for silence and to be in
We're not getting silence here in the middle of Copenhagen, right?
No, no, we're not.
Of course, Danish summer houses come in all shapes and forms. There are some very expensive ones and very lavish ones. But at the core of the identity is something very, very simple. So this frame that you've built here, it wouldn't take much to turn it into a very basic summer house. That's important for a summer house, isn't it? That it should be somewhere kind of a bit shitty in a way, or a bit kind of a place that people aren't worried about getting dirty, or the dog can come in and out from the beach and the kids can paint on the walls. It's that kind of vibe, right? Mm.
That's very important to the studio as well. That's why we actually build in wood. It's local material. It's pretty easy to get your hands on. It's pretty cheap when it's pine wood, as we have here. And we are also very focused on that you don't have too much when you have a summer house, that you can like maybe shower outside, or yeah, simple living in a way. Yeah, it is important that you can actually go out and enjoy the nature that you're in, so it's not a place where you take your work or...
What's the future of the Danish summer house?
I think it's something that's... I think actually it's on its way up in a way. I mean, with the not flying to the other end of the world and actually looking at the local spots we have is really a way, I think, to go. I mean, we have a lot of beautiful nature in Denmark, and going around seeing all these coastal areas and the way that you can just like place a 70 square meters house on the edge of some field looking over a sea, and like being able to go out with a warm cup of coffee in the cold morning and look at the horizon, I think that's just wonderful.
So maybe plane shame will lead to a boost in the Danish summer house.
Maybe, yeah, could be.
So you're part of a larger exhibition here at the Danish Architecture Centre. How does this fit into the theme? What is the theme of the exhibition?
The theme is upcoming architecture studios. It's also a new way to look at architecture. How do we do that? And I think the new approach that we have is the connection to the site and really like moving out on the site, still drawing there, still doing things by hand, still like getting this whole sense of the nature that we're building in instead of just sitting behind our screens.
For Monocle in Copenhagen, I'm Michael Booth.
Our thanks to Michael and to Yasmin Kokseby too from Mette Lang Architects. You can see the practices installation at the Danish Architecture Centre until the 16th of February, and I'd suggest you head along. Well, we're coming to the end of this week's edition, but before we go, we're popping past the Turks Inn in Brooklyn. The restaurant in Bushwick has been pleasing customers since opening in 2019, with its quaintly kitsch design that resembles something from a Wes Anderson movie. The inspiration for the Turks Inn was a former restaurant in rural Wisconsin, founded by Armenian immigrant George the Turk Gogian and his wife Isabella. Far from a small-town affair, the diner became popular with everyone from locals to a passing John F. Kennedy, if you've heard of him. The restaurant shuttered in 2014 after 80 years of service, but two friends for whom the Turks Inn was a nostalgic part of their childhoods couldn't quite say goodbye. Tyler Erickson and Varun Kataria reopened their childhood favourite in New York. They recently met Monocle's editor-at-large Ed Stocker. Here's Varun.
Well, it all began at an auction. Tyler and I were attending the auction of the estate of the Turks Inn. We didn't have a plan. We just knew that we were going to go. And by the time the weekend was over, we'd basically won the bar and everything inside. And that was step number one. Nobody told us that we'd actually have to dismantle it ourselves. I said, when are you guys going to deliver the bar to us? You're going to have to do this yourself.
So when that time came and you were both, hey, let's go to auction and see if we can buy the contents of a dinner club, were you thinking we're going to open a restaurant? Did you know, Tyler, what you were going to do with this bounty?
We knew we wanted to save the Turks Inn in some way. The plan was to reopen it somehow, somewhere. I was living in New York at the time. Varun was in Minneapolis. And, you know, the original initiative came from trying to keep as much of this core collection from the Turks Inn together as possible. And exactly how we would do it, how the reassembly would happen, that all came later. The first phase was just preserving.
It seems like this is very much something that is very important to you. It seems like you have strong memories of the original Turks Inn, and you guys have also known each other for over 2 decades. Maybe you can just tell us, Varun, what the Turks Inn meant to you and the sort of memories you have of it from your childhood.
When you first walk into the Turks Inn, you're confronted with just a riot of pattern and texture and a mixing of cultures in the East, the Silk Road, the Midwest. In the summers, we would drive up to Tyler's cabin, and almost religiously, we would stop at the Turks Inn. And we were always attracted to eccentricity, and the Turks Inn was certainly a part of that fascination for us.
Tyler.
You never knew if it was going to be open or not. So as we got close to the driveway, we would hope that it was open that night. Margie, the daughter of the original owner, George, still ran the place, and she was behind the bar. She would make you a gin and tonic and then shuffle back to the kitchen to put a steak on the grill. And talking to Margie and getting some stories about the original Turks and its heyday was part of the ritual of each visit as well.
I'm interested in this idea of preservation and how that sort of plays into what you do. And it's kind of interesting the fact that you're bringing something from outside, from Wisconsin, into New York. Maybe, Varun, you can talk a bit about that.
Sure. I mean, the loss of culture and history is something that I think we are confronting as a whole society. And certainly that's a problem in New York with so many of our historic institutions closing, people losing very fond places where memories have been made and where communities have been formed. And for us, it was a very conscious initiative or motivation on our part to try to save beloved institutions. So in this space, you will find remnants of the Turks Inn, but you'll also find a tufted door from a supper club called Nye's from Minneapolis, which was once regarded as the best bar in America. You will find little touches of the past in our effort to sort of maintain their presence in our current experience and making new memories with these very rich, laden objects.
Tyler?
We've made a DJ booth out of what once were revolving doors from the Biltmore Hotel, which was next door to Grand Central Station with the same architect. And we found these brass doors in St. Paul, Minnesota at my aunt's salvage yard, basically, and trucked it back to New York. So there are touches of institutions and beloved places everywhere. Our favorite places are old places. And when you walk into a room and you feel that lived-in quality, when you walked into the original Turks, the air was thick with memories. And you could really feel that. And that's something that's disappearing, like you said, every day. You read about a beloved place that vanishes. So that was definitely part of the goal via this mothership that picks up the Turks Inn in Wisconsin and plops it down in the middle of Bushwick to add something that was old, that had some history, that had some memories.
Did you set about recreating everything as micro as the menus? And I can see you also do matches. Was everything meant to be a bit of a homage to the original?
Very much so. I mean, the devil is in the details for us. And so down to the cocktail napkins, down to even our business cards, we wanted as many touch points as possible where we could display and show some of the original design techniques and intent of Turks. And of course, appropriating it in our own way and curating, mixing and matching some of these signs and symbols to express our new take.
That required us bucking a lot of graphic design trends and, you know, the way you normally do things. Because Turks ran for 80 years, we have different representations of their graphical identity from each of those decades. So we have ended up using many different fonts, many different graphics from over the years at Turks, all in one place. Rather than having one clean Turks Inn logo, we have several, 5 or 6, that all represent different periods of the original restaurant.
I think we should maybe head upstairs and we can talk more from the roof. Well, the first thing you notice when you come up on the roof is this incredible sign that says Turks Inn, welcome, and then underneath the Sultan Room. We've got some sort of eastern looking roofs pictured on there, and the paint is chipped off from age. Is this, I'm assuming, another gem from auction, Tyler?
Yeah, so this sign hung on the side of Highway 63 for 80 years, endured 80 Wisconsin winters, and it weighs about 1,000 pounds. It was no small feat to get it down, and We loaded it into the semi-truck with everything else, and 5 years later, after going to those auctions, it's here now in Brooklyn.
Varun.
People ask me, why did you guys call it the Turk's Inn and the Sultan Room? And I often say, it's because that's what the sign says. In a sense, the sign is where we built this entire concept off of. You look at that sign and you have the kind of DNA of this entire project. And it was through looking at this thing and kind of conceiving of it, all emanated off the sign. If the Sultan Room wasn't written there, we might not have one.
Tyler Erickson and Varun Kataria there, speaking to Monocle's very own Ed Stocker at the Turk's Inn in Brooklyn. And sadly, that's all we have time for on today's show. For even more design delights, do hit subscribe to this show. And you'll also get our mini midweek podcast, That's On Design Extra. Where do we come up with the names? That is available each Thursday. You can also head to monocle.com for more information about our monthly magazine, our fleet of newspapers, our libraries of brilliantly bound books, and all of our collaborations and products too, if that's your sort of thing. Monocle on Design was produced by Tom Hall, and it was edited by the ever-patient May Lee Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.